You're listening to the Green Room podcast from Sustainable Wales. Find out more about what we do at sustainablewales.org.uk.
Now that Harborough is, as I said, from Wrigley Gower, Crofty, Pen Club, that area. We're so delighted that to come tonight. This will be my first occasion to read to listen to Natalie's poems. I've got to confess, I never read anything by Natalie either. So I'm living in hope that you're going to be marvellous. And say about 10 minutes, and then you come back soon, but not too long, when we've all read something else, and we'll be completing night with a shuddering climax. Okay, well, Natalie Ann Harborough, thank you.
You mentioned Kevin Brin, actually, because I'm meant to run up there tomorrow for the next chapter of my running book, and it's the worst decision I've ever made on a Saturday morning. But talking of Penclawdd, Crofty, I live in Crofty, but Penclawdd has the more interesting history. It's where there's a huge cockle industry, and I read more about the women who were working there, the backbreaking work that they did, and I read that they picked 150 kilograms of cockles a day, their donkeys there. And before the railway was built there, they'd walk 8 miles into Swansea Market, and they'd do that every single day. I just thought, I have to write something about this as I started delving into it. The Cockle Women of Penclawdd. Rushing towards them and away again, this pulse of water is never still. Sometimes a silvered blade in the mud flats, sometimes freezing, ankle gorged. The Cockle Women are wading out to their ankles, skirts hitched, baskets hunkered to their spines, boots plunged into sludge and cordgrass. The sun has not yet warmed the marshes as they move in half darkness, following a shift in the water's trajectory. Bent double, backsides pushed against the sky, the women scrabble, breaking cockles from sand with quick pulls to riddle them free from their beds. Donkeys shivering at their sides, hooves thrust against the swell of glutted sacks, shells clattering, those glittering mollusks, sometimes squirming, sometimes rattling with sand, empty where nature had got there first. So little universe, it was probably the longest book I took to write, so I had a year and a half to 2 years of not writing in between it, and I generally thought I'd have to give up poetry, but then during lockdown, my grandfather, who was like a best friend to me, I lived with him at the time, he got diagnosed with cancer, and the loss of him and having to watch him, to lose him slowly, writing became that comfort again. And everyone sort of needed that comfort from words. A lot of people were getting into poetry, or they were going out on walks, reconnecting with nature. So we'd have that dichotomy of we'd have hospitals being flashed up on the TV, and then we'd have those sort of 30-minute mandated walks where we'd go out into nature, and it was those two things that stuck in my mind. And when I was with my grandfather in Singleton Hospital, you can see Swansea Bay outside the window, and the one thing we'd tell him is, you know, you've got a nice view here, which is little hope when given the circumstances, but Gower was a very special place to both of us. So this collection goes between the lives within a hospital, whether that's the patients or the hospital workers, and then the life outside, the Gower that's so special to me. And Little Universe is taken from a poem about my little nephew, who's autistic but sees the world very differently. But I thought about being in that hospital, everyone had their own little world, their own little universes, their own things that they were dealing with. So I'm going to go back to the hospital setting now. So this is looking at the porter. And without thinking, my tattooed hands are shunting a precarious wheelchair, awoken by its heaviness. A door lies back for me to enter, and a patient crawls from his eye. She asks me how I came to be working here, and I tell her the job is good, that the people are nice, carefully omitting how some stories weigh more than others, how some corridors stretch farther than ever expected, and how sometimes we hear hurricanes roar in the wheels that rattle ahead of us. So the next poem, I'm going to take it back into Gower, and this was sort of written for a project on sort of rewilding a certain area, and I had to sort of recite this poem over and over and over about 40 times just to get it right for the video. And I knew it off by heart, and the problem is I can't remember a single line of it now when I come to do readings, so I have to read it off the page. So it was an absolute waste of time. Tell it to the trees. When summer strides off with its head hanging bright as a lemon, the closing heaven giving way to a bloat of lavender clouds, the oak with its crown of copper bending low, its branches would clutch for the mud of your heart if it could, moss peppering the wood, its mind ruffling with crows. Tell it to the trees, to the branches cupped in your open palm blooming to sudden angles, pale as candles melting down. A swell of leaves unlatching in the last of the yellow afternoon, when the sun is a shrinking balloon untethered from your grasp, when the clouds unclasp and the dark earth steams with drizzle. Tell it to the trees, that familiar breeze whipping the hazel bare, raking each strand of your hair skyward. There's a certain moment of quiet that can only emerge from the wild. Those red leaves go on raining to soothe what's reeling inside. And the next one was dedicated to my little nephew. I mentioned that he's autistic, he's non-verbal, but he has he's very smart. He can talk, but he can't communicate. And one of the things he loves to do to soothe himself is to put the planets in order along his bedroom rug. And I remember watching him for hours doing that. And just sort of, I've learned a lot from him about how his world sort of looks a bit different. And I wanted to dedicate this one to him. Little universe. Every morning he chants the planets as though in prayer, rolling plastic spheres until they align across his bedroom rug. For hours he kneels tight-lipped, nudging Jupiter back into orbit, rolling Mars across synthetic wool. Clasping Earth in his pudgy hands, he lifts it up, taps at the green, inspects its brilliance. Puzzling the solar system, he taps each planet as it goes, putting order back into his bright little universe. Time. I'll just do two more. So the next one I'm going to do is Springtide. So nearby where I live, there's a sheep farmer who my partner knows, and I nagged and nagged one year to go and feed the lambs, not knowing that where they were going to be sent after mine, so I was devastated afterwards. But when I was chatting to him, he was telling me how he swears that he knows how to get out of bed because he knows when the sheep are going to birth, because they do it with the tides, and he says that it's the moisture that they can feel through the ground. I don't know whether this is true, but he's absolutely convinced, and this, I thought, right, this is, I'm going to have to write a poem about this before the other poets hear about it. So, Springtide.
Are they competitive? Well, they are competitive.
You hear a little fact thing, no, someone's going to write this, I need to get to it.
Well, that's a little bit like that Nigel Jenkins poem, I'll get a poem out of this.
Yeah. The farmers here say their ewes know the tides, that when it tops 7 metres, the lambing will start, and the farmers will tear from their pillows. It's their hooves, they say, the moisture rising through samphire, sea thrift, fescue, darkening wool like days-old bandages, telling the body to push. The breath holds behind the teeth, estuary swollen, the womb paused mid-squeeze, and yet here I am, thinking of those waiting sheep as I sit in the car park outside maternity, my sister somewhere inside having sweated and punched for hours, barely noticing the water that's heaved itself up to her window, spilling fresh salt over the tiles. So my little Nettie was born during lockdown as well, and that kind of came from not being able to see her at the time. And for the final one of this half, I'm going to do You Won't Always Recognise Hope When You See Her, because I like to think that even though this is a book about grief, it's also a book about hope. You won't always recognise hope when you see her. Sometimes she's hunched in the visitor's room, rolling a magazine into a batten, thumping her thigh like a Labrador tail, waiting for someone to show. Sometimes she stretched tenderly across the bed, fingers crowding her mother's wrist, interrogating the blood for movement. And sometimes she's outside spinning coils of smoke like prayers into the bitter air, light crawling across her brow, angling her phone for signal. Maybe you missed her, ankle deep, footprints engulfed by the salt marsh, her mother's hand cream not quite laundered from her glove. Suppose she swims to you easily over disinfected tiles, sipping the bruised violet shine of the morning. Or else she clatters in quite unexpectedly, through the vents in the hospital ceiling, belts of seaweed wrapping her waist to tell you the tide's come in.
Thank you. Nathaniel Holbrook from Crofty, Penglove, second reading, and I'm going to buy your little universe book. Afterward, and the book is on sale from Parthen. If anybody else would like to buy it, at least I know we have an arrangement to see with Seren Books. They have a spinner downstairs. Now, I told Parthen this, but they don't deliver any books to us, so it's hard for us to print on a spinner. But
we can certainly, if you want to leave a few behind.
Oh, we could.
I happily recommend its predecessor as well.
I love the Erlinger. Which is called?
Small.
Small. It's beautiful.
Okay, well, speak to Peter after.
Thank you.
And he can stock the bicycle purchase one.
Oh, thank you very much.
With real money. Natalie Ann Holborough.
I've really enjoyed all your readings, so thank you. I've had a mix of different sort of moods to go through, and I quite enjoy that. Like, my favourite bit of coming to do readings is to sit there and listen a lot of the time. So, runners, right? They're probably the one sort of person that you don't want to get stuck next to at a party is a runner, right?
You go to parties?
I'm one of those
You're
people.
Lucky.
Yeah. I'm one of those people, and I will bore you if you start asking me about running. But this one I have to write because I read in 2023 that 93% of women don't feel safe when they're running. And I've experienced this, and every single woman I know who runs has experienced this, and they have to think about so much more when they go out. You know, it's all very well, January, people tell you, oh, you know, it's free, just go for a run. January, you've got dark nights, it's very difficult, and there's a lot more planning involved, and there's a lot more worry for your safety. So I wrote Run Like a Girl. Only every other street light works. So for each dark shutter, there's a surprise abyss opening beneath her. A languid sheet of sweat developing at her neck, heels skimming the dirt, battering the draft of whatever she's running from this time. Only she's at her checkpoint already, toes scuffing the world. Car horns don't keep her. She constructs a rocket of herself, launches the other way, shadows clambering the hems of her patterned shorts, ponytail Catherine wheeling, always facing the violent headlights, hoping for tailwinds behind her. So the next one was one I wrote in dedication to my grandfather, and there's a lot of them about my grandfather in this. And one thing he always did for me every year was he'd pick the first strawberry from the garden, and he'd always leave it there for me to eat whenever I came home from school or college or uni. And he'd picked it, before he went into hospital, he picked it and he left it there. So when I came home after he'd gone, that's the one year I didn't eat that strawberry, and so I wrote this poem for him instead. Strawberries. Outside, the garden is still the garden you waved from, face blurred by the panes of the greenhouse. Inside, the emptiness is inexplicable, despite the splendour of arachnids, vines widening to scrolls. The strawberry bed is full of itself, blistering with redness. Only one plucked berry turns soft on the chopping board, the first of the season. No hunger could make me put it anywhere near my mouth. So I'm going to move on now. So a lot of my writing is rewriting a lot of Greek myth, and certainly in small I did that. But I couldn't resist putting another one in. I thought I haven't actually written that much around male characters from the Iliad. And I thought about Paris, and I thought he's probably the most wet character in the whole book. I thought I'm going to have some fun with him. I'm going to put him in his hospital set, and he's late for an appointment. He's flirting with the nurses, and I'm just going to see what's happened. He's been injured in battle. Paris. He pauses to smooth his hair in the rearview mirror of the 4x4 he's straddled across two spaces, a 340-horsepower engine he's nursed around the car park for 15 minutes, unusually early. Appointment letter crunched in his fist, knuckling dread, a packet of cigarettes for the wait ahead. 15 minutes pass, blowing battle cries into smoke clouds, wheezing out some deeper pain, holding out at the door for as long as his name takes to summon him in, rusty arrow pushing through the shoulder's plane of skin, wolf whistling his way through reception. Later he'll sit upon tomato-red plastic, yank up his sleeve, await the sting, torchlight dazzling his eyes to check he's still in. I've done a few. It's taken me years and years to be able to write about the experience of having type 1 diabetes. I spent a lot of years very angry about it, and it was the one thing I couldn't get into words. And it was only when I started writing this that it became easier, and it felt like a weight off my mind just to be able to write these things. And one of the things that's very difficult to describe is how you feel when your blood sugars are at different levels. So whether that's, they should be around between 5 and 7. So I've done a poem based on how I feel depending on where my blood sugars are and how I'd act. Balancing act. 3.7. Beside the bed, a bright heap of gummy bears tumble out of the packet like aliens, landing in lamplight. I take one lurid green, lean into the haze, topple a glass, darken the carpet that drags me shivering into its currents. 5.5. Briefly, my body is a perfect machine, elated by this fleeting sense of balance, circulating what needs to be shifted. The rain that runs at everything has never felt so clean as it does now, dancing off my fingers, filling the throats of tulips, red and sweet. 18.2. Like dunking your head upside down into warm bath water, or trying to open your eyes in the wind. Left long enough suspended in molasses, slowly percolating, I'll pour rivers into the rasp of my gullet, shrug myself yawning off the bone. 1.8. In the pool changing room of all places, freezing and nude, scrabbling for orange juice. The straw stabs hopelessly for the little foil circle. Wet hair dangling like ropes, drips oozing down my neck. Some clear, some fulgent orange, some of them trembling with salt. So I'll just finish with a couple more. So
you can ask, could I ask,
yeah,
what does having diabetes, or how does having diabetes alter your life, if it does?
It does. So concentration is a big one. I've tend to be, you're thinking about numbers all the time. So I've got an insulin pump attached to me, but I've got to be aware constantly of where those levels are. And often I can feel it before I look at it, and I've got alerts set up on there. But it affects everything, basically. You just got to kind of go with it, just try and balance it out where you can. So many things affect it, it's quite difficult. So writing can be a bit of an escape sometimes. Okay, so I was trying to fill up some poems for this collection. I cut the space theme started to come in. And so I woke my partner at 1 a.m. and said, right, you know stuff about space, give me a fact. He was really pissed off, obviously, but he did give me a fact. And it's that Europa has seas beneath its surface that are twice as low as the Earth's floor. And I thought, right, another one that I've got to get in before the other poets do. Europa.
I think there are certain people who've written about Europa.
Oh, yes. But poets I know.
Oh, right.
They're not putting that in their collections. Pierce Europa's 15-mile deep skin of ice, and we might find an ocean grinding beneath it twice as low as the Earth's floor. And if scientists think that life can exist in such impossibly dark places, breathing out as though to melt snow or clean a forgotten mirror. Imagine what could go on living miraculously behind these walls, like lucky astronauts thump landing onto a resplendent moon. Where am I? What do I finish with? I'm gonna finish with a slightly happier one. And it's one, again, in dedication to my granddad, but the idea that he's kind of that I always feel his presence, especially when my book launch was actually on his birthday, and I imagine he definitely would have been there because the wine was Pinot Grigio, and I thought he'd definitely be in the corner drinking wine tonight. Constellation. Turning somewhere below Auriga's bright wheel, there's a sea too dark to make out the seams. A row of lindens rustling black, the breeze mechanical, still breathing. Each night the window flashes up like a brilliant cry. Quietly, I'll excuse myself from his bedside. Look up once, twice, squint for the edge, for a pebble of light within arm's reach, for a constellation prickling into view, a moon skimmed off bitter shores. Once I half expected his hand to unfurl and point it out for me, 657 square degrees of sparkling chariot, Capella trembling with fierce light. If he could, he might have landed from some other world, pushed a fingertip up to the glass to show me where it's always been, where it will still be without him. Thank you.
Now, Anne Holroth, thank you so much.
Thank you.